Okay, let's go ahead and get started. Good morning, everyone. Is there anybody out there? That was your cue, usually when someone says good morning.
Yo!
What? Yo! Did you guys all enjoy the party last night? Yeah? All right. Well, it's nice that you could make it this morning to talk a little bit more about Exchange Server 2013. So for those of you who weren't at my sessions the other day, my name is Scott Schnall. I'm a principal technical writer on the Exchange team. And this session, we're going to be covering deployment and coexistence with Exchange Server 2013. So how many of you are on 2007 today? All right. How many of you are on 2010? All right. Anybody earlier, 2003? Anybody 2000? No, you're not going to raise your hand. That's not right. All right, well, good. So for those of you who are on 2003, you may have heard in one of my earlier presentations, or maybe you've read some of the documentation that we have online. So you know there's not really a direct path to go from 2003 to 2013. We don't allow them to coexist in the same forest. So your choices would be to use a third-party tool or do some sort of a skip upgrade where you go from 2003 to 2010, then to 2013, or save yourself a step and do a cross-forest migration from 2003 to 2013. But for those of you on 2007 or 2010, I'm going to walk you through what the upgrade process would look like. We'll talk about what coexistence will look like. It's a little bit different from what we had when you were going from, say, for example, 2007 to 2010. There are some differences that we have for the upgrade path as well, whether you're coming from 2007 to 2013, or whether you're coming from 2010 to 2013 as well. So the agenda that I have is pretty straightforward. I'm just going to talk about the fundamentals of deployment. We'll talk about how things like sedevent has changed. We'll talk about what some of the new prerequisites are, not just for the deployment, but for coexistence as well. We'll talk about how to actually do the upgrade from 2007 to 2010. We'll talk about public folder migrations, and I forgot to add a bullet. I'm also going to talk about virtualization as well, which, by the way, wasn't originally planned for this session, but we got so many questions about it this week that I decided to go ahead and add some content for you and let you know what our virtualization support stance is with 2013 and what our best practices are. So let's start with the fundamentals, and let's start with the prerequisites. And the prerequisites, when we talk about those, that's going to be obviously contextual. So the prereqs will depend on where you're coming from and what your deployment topology is going to look like. So obviously, the prereqs for generically installing an Exchange 2013 server are largely going to be the same. But the prereqs outside the server, the rest of the topology, the rest of your infrastructure, things like Active Directory, the server operating system you choose, and so forth, those will also be different depending on whether you're coming from 2007 or 2010 as well. So the supported coexistence scenarios, I already said this in the beginning, we only support Exchange 2013 in the same forest, in the same Exchange organization with 2007 and 2010. So no 2003 support. And in fact, to get coexistence, you actually need to apply some software that hasn't been released yet. In the case of Exchange 2010, you have to have Service Pack 3. Okay, Service Pack 3 is not out yet. Don't go looking for it. You also need, with 2007, obviously SP3 for 2007 is out, but there is a coexistence roll-up update that's needed as well. Now, as of today, our belief is that the update roll-up that you'll need for 2007 is the latest one that we already released, Update Roll-up 8. Came out a few weeks ago, and that has all the code in it that we need Exchange 2007 to know about in order to do the coexistence with Exchange 2013. So that is already available. However, because we have not finished and finalized developing Exchange 2013, things could change. There could be a later update roll-up that we need to deploy, and so therefore, that's why we have some of the asterisks there that these things could change or they don't exist yet. Now, supported clients, well, obviously Outlook is going to be a supported client, but not every version. Typically, we go N-2, so the current brand new version will be Outlook 2013. So N-2 would be 2010 and 2007. No Outlook 2003 support. And if you were in the architecture session, you know that all Outlook clients, no matter which version you use, are only going to be using RPC over HTTP, or what we call Outlook Anywhere. There is no MAPI over TCP anymore. It's all encapsulated in HTTPS and sent to the server that way. Entourage for the Mac. If you have Entourage clients, you have to use the client that uses web services, because there is no other way for those clients to connect up to Exchange. So if you have a legacy Entourage client, for instance, an Entourage client that uses WebDAV, which doesn't exist in 2013, and in fact didn't exist in 2010, then you'll have to go ahead and upgrade that client to the web services edition. And of course, Outlook for the Mac 2011 is also a supported client. Now, when we talk about these clients, obviously we're talking about the big rich clients, but certainly we have other clients, Outlook Web App, for example, where we support a variety of web browsers, certainly Internet Explorer, but of course we also support Safari, Firefox, and Chrome as well. Active Sync devices, I'd be willing to bet that every single person in this room has an Active Sync device, and it's most likely a supported device against Exchange 2013 as well. So lots of different clients to choose from, lots of different paths that you can take. There is no requirement to upgrade your clients at the same time you're upgrading the server, unless, of course, you have an unsupported client or a client that won't work. You'll still get Outlook 2007 working just like it does now against 2013. You'll still have Outlook 2010 working just like it does today against Exchange 2010 or 2013. So just keep that in mind. Active Directory. The Active Directory requirements actually haven't changed for Exchange in a long time. We don't really have hardcore requirements for things like bandwidth, latency, the decision as to whether to go one site, two sites, etc. Generally, we rely solely on the Active Directory team for that kind of guidance. So from the Exchange perspective, we really just need Active Directory to be there for us, and we're not doing anything special or unique that requires you to upgrade AD. We require really just a minimum of Windows Server 2003 for AD in order to deploy Exchange. As long as you meet that minimum requirement, you don't have to touch your directory servers if you don't want to. Now, there may be other reasons that you want to do that. Maybe you're doing hardware turnovers or other things, but Exchange is not going to be a driver that will cause you to have to upgrade AD. Now, how many of you are using read-only DCs or read-only GCs? Okay, the support stance for those is the same as it was in 2010. They can coexist in the environment, but both Outlook and Exchange still need writable directory servers. So you can have them in the environment, but you have to have writable ones in the environment as well. Outlook and Exchange will simply ignore directory servers that they cannot write to. And if they don't have any writable servers, they will not function. Services won't start, and nothing will work. So you have to make sure that even if you are going down the path of RODC or ROGC, that you have writable directory servers everywhere you put Exchange. Supported namespaces, that is also the same as what we had in 2010. And this could change in a future release, but we have committed to supporting these types of DNS namespaces in RTM. So if you're in any one of these non-standard naming topologies, then you're still in a supported state. You don't have to do anything to prepare yourself from Exchange. Now, that having said, some of these namespaces we generally don't think of as a good idea. The one that usually stands out is the single label domain. So if you don't know, the single label domain is a DNS domain name that doesn't have a top level domain with it. So instead of Microsoft.com, a single label domain would just be Microsoft. It would almost be analogous to a NetBIOS name. Single label domains are supported, but they're generally not a good idea. Some customers still do them, but they're generally not a good idea. Active Directory isn't a particular fan of them. Exchange isn't a particular fan of them, but we're supporting them because if you look at where customers are today in that situation, those customers with a single label domain, many of them already have existing Exchange infrastructure. And you may be aware that you can't just go ahead and rename things when Exchange is in the mix. You can't rename an Exchange server, can't rename the organization, and of course, you can't rename any domains once Exchange is in the mix. The other namespaces, the contiguous, obviously that's the more traditional namespace. I would be willing to bet that a large majority of you are running in a contiguous namespace, but we also support the non or discontiguous namespaces as well, single label domain, and of course the disjoint DNS namespaces. The operating system, this should really come as no surprise to anybody who's been paying attention to Exchange. Obviously, we're 64-bit only still. We went down that path way, way back with Exchange 2007. So you're always going to need a 64-bit version of Windows to run on. And we support Windows Server 2008 R2, and we support Windows Server 2012. Okay, so the choice is yours as to what you want to go to. In terms of the addition of operating system, that's going to be driven by what version you're using. If you're using Windows Server 2008, then you're probably going to go with the standard edition for your client access servers and the enterprise edition for your mailbox servers, the enterprise edition, therefore having the clustering feature so that you can do things like a database availability group. There's generally never any reason to use the enterprise edition of Windows for a dedicated client access server. Never ever do that. There's no reason to do that. The only time you need enterprise in Windows 2008 is when you want to do a DAG and you need the clustering features. Now, you may have heard that in Windows Server 2012, there is no Enterprise Edition. Okay, because all the goodness that we had in the Enterprise Edition has made its way into Standard Edition. So you don't need Enterprise Edition when you're running Windows Server 2012, because clustering is part of Standard. So there's really only two versions of Windows 2012 that Exchange cares about. We don't support web, we don't support core, but we do support standard and data center. And the only difference between those two, in case you haven't heard, is the virtualization licensing. That is the only difference between the two. If you don't need unlimited virtualization or all the licensing bells and whistles that comes with it, you'll be using Windows 2012 Standard Edition. If you're a heavily virtualized shop and you want the added advantages that you get from the license packaging that we've done with data center, you may want to deploy data center. Both packages, both operating systems have clustering in them, so both will work just fine. But I think most customers are going to be pretty happy just staying with the standard edition of Windows 2012 for Exchange purposes. There's also other components that we need. Obviously, we're doing a lot of stuff with HTTP. We're doing stuff with remote PowerShell. We've got other OS and IIS components that we need in there. We're a managed code application, so we need the .NET framework. We need Windows remote management capabilities with remote PowerShell and those features, so they have to be on the box. And then we also need a component called the UCMA, the Unified Communications Managed API. And that gives us the UM stack that we need. And that is something that, even though almost all of the UM functionality has been moved into the mailbox role, you actually need UCMA on both CAS and mailbox. There are little stubs inside of CAS that do the SIP answering and the redirection for the calls when a UM caller is calling in. So you do need UCMA on all of your Exchange servers. And in fact, generally, there's only one thing that you'll put on a mailbox server that you won't put on a CAS, and that's the Microsoft Office filter pack. And the filter pack is there so that we can do content indexing of Office files that are stored in email messages. So that's something else that's needed as well. One of the other things that I don't talk about on this slide, but those of you who have Exchange 2010, you probably have seen that Exchange can actually go ahead and install the Windows operating system prerequisites for you. Okay? We still have that ability in Exchange 2013 as well. So you don't have to take the separate step of running that lengthy command to install IIS and all the other things that we would need. You can just start with Exchange Setup and allow Exchange Setup to go ahead and lay those prerequisites on the box for you. And what's really cool is, just like we had in 2010, if you need to reboot the box after doing that, you can reboot them, and when you restart setup, it knows where it left off, and it will just continue on its way. So it's a great experience that we've actually enhanced somewhat in 2012. So let's talk a little bit about what it would take to actually prepare and do an upgrade from both 2010 or 2007 over to 2013. And I think you're going to find it's actually a pretty and simple and straightforward process. And in fact, those of you coming from Exchange 2010 will have it slightly better than those of you coming from Exchange 2007. And you'll see why that is in a moment. And where there are differences, I've highlighted in them in the deck so we can call them out. So to prepare for it, I always like to step back a bit before we do the deployment to help customers understand the architectural changes, because if you don't understand the architecture of the system and all the moving parts that surround it and how they work, you're not really going to be able to design a system that meets your needs. So as we look at the architectural differences between, for example, 2010 and 2013, you can see that in 2010, we had pretty much this stack right here. We had a layer 7 load balancer up at the top, and then below that was typically the client access server array, and that was typically front-ending into a database availability group. And of course, we had the separate server roles as well, CAS, hub, UM, and so forth. So all that functionality has been split out and moved around so that we now are only using the client access server role basically for authentication and proxy and redirection, and it's the mailbox role, as you can see here, is doing all of the heavy lifting. It's got all the protocols, it has all the business logic, it does all the data rendering, it has the data transport, the transport pipeline, the mailboxes themselves, and basically everything you come to love about an Exchange server. So understanding these architectural differences, and in particular with respect to load balancing, now you can start to understand how you would design this. In 2010, your design methodology was very different from how you're going to do it in 2013. We have very many requirements in 2010 that simply no longer exist. For instance, we give you the option to now, innately within the product, without having to go for expensive third-party networking equipment, to have a single worldwide namespace. One URL for all your users. We've also taken some of the work that load balancers were previously doing, namely the session affinity, and we've moved that away from the load balancer, and we've put that over into the mailbox, so that everything that happens with respect to a user's mailbox, it's all happening in that session on that server, which we call, as you heard, an island. Okay. So let's move forward and see what the upgrade path looks like. So we're going to first walk through the upgrade from Exchange 2010 to Exchange 2013, and you're going to see that the steps are familiar. If you've gone from 2007 to 2010, some of these steps are going to be familiar with you. But you'll also notice, particularly if you've gone through that before, some of the more painful steps that you may be used to are no longer there. We've taken care of some of those things for you. So in this example, what we have here, we've got our clients up at the top. We've got our internet-facing AD site. It's running Exchange 2010. It's got Hub and CAS and Mailbox. And just as an aside, in Exchange 2010, really the preferred deployment model is a multi-role box. CAS, Hub, and Mailbox all on the same server. I've split them out here simply for illustration purposes. It doesn't matter if you have single roles or multi-roles, the process that you'll go through will be exactly the same. So we've got our internet-facing site. We always want you to start with an internet-facing site. That's not new. We've been doing that in Exchange for many years now. And once the internet-facing sites are done, then you can move forward and do the non-internet-facing sites. So here's how it works. It's pretty simple. First, you're going to have to go get that prerequisite software once we release it. And that means, for example, installing Service Pack 3 for Exchange 2010. Now, I realize some of you are probably looking at the slide right now, reading that line that says install it across the org. Yes, that's exactly what we mean. By across the org, that means you're going to put this service pack on every single Exchange 2010 server that you have. And unless and until you do that, you won't be able to move forward with Exchange 2013. So there is going to be a bit of a groundwork that you have to lay. But again, it's just so we have the necessary bits on the down-level boxes so they can understand and participate meaningfully in conversations with the up-level and newer servers. After you've done that, then we recommend that you go ahead and validate the environment, and you're going to do this step multiple times because we like to validate as we go along. And the tool that we recommend you use is the Exchange Server Remote Connectivity Analyzer, or EXRCA. How many of you have heard of the Remote Connectivity Analyzer? Excellent. If you haven't heard of it, www.exrca or https://www.testexchangeconnectivity.com. Both of those are our URLs. And if you haven't used it, this is a web service that we have in our data center. And it's a web service that allows you to validate access or messaging flow for your system from an external perspective. The idea being that After an administrator's just deployed their first CAS server, first thing they do is fire up Outlook web app, check their mailbox, make sure things work. But typically it's not until later on when they go home and they can see if things are working from outside the firewall. We wanted a shortcut process for that, and a couple gentlemen on our product quality team came up with EXRCA as that mechanism. So the admins don't have to wait to go home. They can go to this website, put in information, including credentials that we will use to access the infrastructure, and we'll tell you whether or not connectivity was successful. And what's even better is if connectivity isn't successful, and that could be for a variety of reasons, bad certificate, firewall didn't answer, couldn't resolve a DNS, any number of reasons, we will tell you what the problem is and give you a pretty good idea as to how to fix it. So it's a great tool. If you haven't tried it, I strongly recommend it. So you'll validate the environment using that tool. We also have a variety of built-in test commandlets that we ship with Exchange, and you can use those as well to do things like test MAPI connectivity, test Outlook Anywhere, et cetera, et cetera. Once you've verified that the environment is good, you're ready to proceed. That's when you'll prep your AD. Okay, there, of course, are going to be schema changes with Exchange 2013. You will have to do them in order to move forward. You don't necessarily need to do them separately. You've always had the choice of doing them separately or with the first server that you install. If they're not there, the first server will simply add the schema changes to AD for you. For those of you in a very large Active Directory environment, though, you probably will want to stage this. You're probably going to want to go ahead and allow the schema updates to be made, wait for replication to go throughout the environment, then revalidate the environment before moving forward with the rest of it. If you're in a very small Active Directory environment, yes, there are a lot of schema changes, but they will replicate very quickly. Okay, so if you're in a small environment, you could probably bang it out over an evening or maybe over a weekend. So once you've done that, now you're ready to deploy your Exchange 2013 servers. And of course, that means deploying both CAS and Mailbox for your first installs. Now historically, with 2007 and 2010, we always wanted you to install the client access role first. In 2013, we always want you to do the Mailbox role first. And that's not a requirement. That's just our recommendation based on this. Remember, the client access server in 2013 is nothing but a lightweight protocol proxy. Okay? It doesn't have any configuration objects. It's not an endpoint for remote PowerShell. In other words, basically, if you install just CAS, you can't do anything with it. There's no management that you could do. There's no way to log into it from ECP or a remote PowerShell because the configuration objects and the business logic and the remote PowerShell endpoint are all on the Mailbox server now. So for convenience, we recommend installing the Mailbox server first. Nothing bad will happen if you do CAS first. I'll have time for questions at the end. So just remember that. I mean, it's good to remember the order, but if you forget and you go with the old school way of doing CAS first, it's not going to harm anything, but you may be surprised until you have that Mailbox server in there that you won't be able to configure anything. So you install your Exchange servers, and then you go ahead and deploy your certificates. Now, those of you who've gone through the upgrade from 2007 to 2010, you probably are having a question here. Well, wait a minute. How come I'm doing the certificates here? We haven't even talked about how the namespaces are going to work. Well, the good news is when you're upgrading from 2010 to 2013, you don't need the legacy namespace anymore. We've taken care of that for you. Now, sadly, for those of you still on Exchange 2007, we're not able to complete that work. It's something that we're looking into, but it's not going to be in there for RTM. Possibly post-RTM, we may change that, but those of you on Exchange 2007 will still have to deal with the legacy namespace, and we'll get into where that step fits in once we talk about the 2007 path. Those of you going from 2010, you don't need a legacy namespace anymore. You simply use the same namespace you're using today, which means the same certificates that you're using today, which means you don't have added cost because you need new certificates, and you simply deploy them on the newly installed 2013 Mailbox and client access servers. Okay, once you have your certificates installed, you're ready to move forward. And actually, I take that back. You only install the certificates on the CAS server. We don't need public certs on the Mailbox server. We only need them on the CAS server. So you won't have to install them on Mailbox. Then you'll go ahead and switch that namespace so that it points over to the new infrastructure. And that is nothing more than going into DNS and changing the record for that FQDN so that it points to the IP address of the load balancer that's sitting in front of your CAS array, your 2013 CAS array. Once that's done and once all the clients refresh and pick up that DNS change, they will now all be redirected over to the new site. Now, of course, before you start telling users and before you start swinging things over, once you've made that namespace change and moved DNS over, of course, you're going to be doing that inside and outside the org, so you want to run the remote connectivity analyzer again and verify that everything is good. Once you've done that, life is good, you're ready to do the cutover and start moving mailboxes. And at this point, once you've done that, even for mailboxes that hasn't been moved, just like we've done historically in the past with previous upgrades, the new server will be the front end for the legacy servers as well. So any users who still have their mailboxes on Exchange 2010 will still log in through the Exchange 2013 CAS, and then 2013 CAS will send them over to the appropriate place, and they'll get their mailbox. And of course, the mailbox experience is still driven by the version of the mailbox server that you're running on. So until the 2010 users have their mailboxes moved over to 2013, they'll see the new front end for logon purposes, but they'll go back to the old OWA for their 2010 mailbox. They won't get the new Outlook web app until they've moved over to 2013. All right, and you can see what that path looks like. And at that point, again, you build out your DAG, move your mailboxes, and eventually get to a point where you'll be decommissioning the old servers. You'll uninstall them in an orderly fashion, and you'll have nothing but a pure 2013 org at that point. And then, of course, if you had non-internet-facing sites, you would move and do the upgrade for them next. All right. So let's talk about 2007. I'm going to go through this a little bit quicker because almost all the steps are identical. There are, like I said, though, the nuance that you had to deal with the legacy namespace. So for 2007, it's going to be the same thing. You're going to have to put those prerequisite bits on your 2007 servers. And just like with 2010 SP3, we also want those bits on every 2007 server you have in your org. We have set up prereq checks, and if you don't do that, setup will not go forward. It'll tell you the environment's not ready, and you have to deploy this on all your servers. So make sure you get that done. Then you'll do the same thing. You'll prepare AD, go ahead and get the schema updates in there, and then validate the environment. Then you'll do the deployment. You'll deploy, again, mailbox and CAS, preferably mailbox first. But again, it's not going to cause any harm if you do CAS first. But preferably mailbox first to make things easier for you from an admin perspective. And then here, this is highlighted in yellow because this step is for Exchange 2007 only. You don't do this with 2010, and that is, again, creating a new legacy namespace. So what do we mean by that? Well, what we're going to do is we're going to have one namespace that's going to be responsible for the new servers, and there will be a legacy namespace that gets silently used in the background by the system to redirect users whose mailboxes are still on 2007. So the legacy namespace isn't something that you give out to users. They still use the same URL that they've accessed before. Silently behind the scenes, though, once they log in and authenticate, and we do an AD lookup to find where their mailbox is, and we determine that their mailbox is on 2007, Exchange will automatically redirect them to the legacy namespace, and they'll be in their mailbox, again, with the 2007 mailbox experience. But the legacy namespace does have to be created, and it's going to go on the certificates in a minute as well. And if you're not familiar with how to do this, it's very simple. It's just another FQDN that you create in DNS, and you assign it the appropriate IP addresses, in this case, the IP address that points to your 2007 infrastructure. And when we say legacy namespace, it can be any namespace that you want. I think a lot of customers, though, have taken us quite literally, both in how we explain it and how we've documented, and many customers actually use the name legacy.mydomain.com. And that's fine. Again, there's no requirement that you use any particular name. There's nothing hard-coded looking for the word legacy in the namespace. It's just what we call that namespace. So you could call it like oldservers.mydomain.com or buybyexchange.mydomain.com. Anything that you want. It doesn't have to be called legacy.mydomain.com. Any namespace that you want. It just has to be different from the primary namespace so that the system can distinguish between the two. Then you'll do the certificates, and here again, it's going to be a very similar process, but unfortunately, because you're adding a legacy namespace, that means you need to go to your certificate provider and ask them to issue you a new certificate that has that new name. Now, some certificate providers are actually pretty good about that. They'll recognize that you've purchased their certificate from them and you're asking for a minor change, so they may not charge you the full price to reissue you a new certificate. Now, I can't speak for them. We're not a CA, so you're not going to come to us and buy it. They may charge you full price. So work with your certification authority, whoever you're buying your certificates from, explain to them what you're doing and why you need this, and who knows? You know, maybe they'll give you some kind of a deal on it. There's no harm in asking. The worst they can do is say no, and then you just pay full price for it. So you get the certificates, you put it on the Exchange 2013 CAS servers, you put it on your Exchange 2007 CAS servers, and you're also going to have to put that on your reverse proxies or your firewalls as well for clients coming from outside the organization so that they can get SSL as well. And then once you've done that, you'll go ahead and do that same switch of the primary namespace. And again, that's nothing more than going into DNS and changing the IP address for your primary namespace to now point to the load balancer that's in front of your 2013 CAS server. And of course, as you do along the way, you're going to be validating and verifying that everything's good, and EXRCA is going to be the preferred tool to do that. Once you've switched the namespace, particularly from an external standpoint, and once you use EXRCA to validate it, once RCA passes those tests, you are good to go. You know that the namespaces are working fine, the redirection is working fine, the certificates are in place, and life is good. All the moving parts have come together. And then just like you did before, you'd build out your DAG and move the mailboxes. And once again, if you had other sites, you would proceed to do those as well. Generally, we like you to do one site at a time to keep things nice and clean and orderly. There's no requirement, though, if you decide, I can't wait for this to be done, I have to do all my sites at once. You can do that. It might not be the best idea. You certainly don't want to do that with the first two servers you install because you're going to run into issues around AD replication and one server seeing that the scheme is not there, so it starts to add the updates, and replication hasn't happened yet, so the other server sees that the scheme is not there, and it tries to do the updates, and now everybody's trying to write to the same scheme and master, and it can be a mess. But once you're past that, once you've gotten over the hump of the schema updates, you can actually deploy servers in an automated and multiple fashion. And you can actually script the whole thing. So it could be server after server after server that gets just deployed in this brick fashion. And you can even take the deployment farther because you can script almost any aspect of Exchange configuration. So once the servers are deployed, you could actually automate the creation of a DAG and adding those servers to the DAG and creating databases and so forth. And a lot of customers have actually done that work to create a lot of this stuff. You might actually look out on the web in some of the TechNet forums. A lot of folks have posted the deployment scripts that they've used. And if you can't find those, go to msteched.com and search for a presentation by my colleague Robert Gillies. Because Robert has done a deployment session where he talks about the scripts that he developed for some of our public sector clients to do the deployments. Okay, so that's what the upgrade process looks like in terms of the individual steps. I just want to briefly dig a little deeper into each step so you have an idea as to what to expect. Because as I was saying earlier, some things about Exchange Setup are slightly different from what we had in 2010. So let's start with the first aspect. That is putting that coexistence update on the servers. I think by now I've pretty much hammered that home. It's just something that you have to do. It's got to, unfortunately, go on all of the servers in the organizations, not just, for instance, the ones in the site you're upgrading. We need, unfortunately, you to touch every single server to do that. And again, for 2010, this is going to be SP3 when it's released. For 2007, as I was saying earlier, we believe that update rollup 8, which we have released, will be the coexistence update that you'll use. But again, because we're not done with the product yet, that could change. You'll prepare AD. You'll go to this website. You'll do the validation. You'll do the installation. Installation has changed somewhat. In 2010 and 2007, we had two types of setup, setup.com for the command line install, setup.exe for the GUI-based install. We have removed setup.com because we don't need it anymore. We now have both options built into setup.exe. So you can use the one same setup executable to do either a command line install or a full GUI install. And in fact, if you do the command line install, that's what it looks like. We use a lot of the same switches we had in 2010. So for instance, /mode, you'd set that to install, obviously. Others are uninstall, if you're curious for that. And then the roles are either going to be client access, or you can just use the letter C, mailbox, or just the letter M, and management tools, or just the letters MT together. And you may have heard, because this is true in Exchange 2010 as well, that you don't necessarily need to have the Exchange management tools on your workstation. Because we use Remote PowerShell, that's all you need on your workstation is Remote PowerShell. So if you don't want to install the management tools, you don't have to. All we're doing when you install the management tools is basically giving you that shortcut for the Exchange management shell and the local copy of the help file that we ship with it. So if you don't want to put that on your system, you don't need it, you can simply use Remote PowerShell. You can use the Exchange Administration Center and have a full fidelity web experience, and you can manage the whole infrastructure that way. There is one new parameter, though, the I accept Exchange Server license terms switch. So obviously, I'm sure all of you have said yes to a million license agreements as you're installing software. Most people don't even read it. They see the screen and they immediately look for the next button. But we still have to have a mechanism whereby we need you for legal purposes to say that, yes, you accept these license terms. So in the GUI, we do that through a checkbox. You check the box and we let you go forward. In the command line, obviously, there is no checkboxes. You have to include this parameter. And because we wanted to make sure there could be no confusion, unlike some of the other setup switches, there is no shortcut for this parameter. You have to type the whole thing out. Now, could we have made it longer? Maybe. It is not case sensitive. That's an excellent question. It is not. It has to be exactly like that with Pascal case. No, it is not case sensitive at all. There's nothing in the command line version of setup where anything is case sensitive at all. So you don't have to worry about that. But you do have to type it correctly, because if you miss one character or mess it up at all, setup's going to say unrecognized parameter. I can't go forward. So just make sure you get that right. Again, there's another opportunity where scripting can help you out. So you'll do the legacy namespace, and again, that's required for 2007, coexistence only. Coexistence only. That's a big deal. Because for those of you who have a small environment, if you can do all the moves over a night or over the weekend, where you can get all your mailboxes off 2007 and get everybody over to 2013 very quickly, then you won't be in a coexistence environment. You'll have upgraded at that point, and you won't need the legacy namespace. But if you can't bang it out at night, or you can't get it done over a weekend, if there's going to be a period of coexistence where there will be 2007 mailbox users side by side with 2013 users, you will have to have the legacy namespace, and it will have to be in play. So you create the records in both internal and external DNS. Of course, we still want you to use split DNS for everything related to Exchange. And then you'll validate that again using EXRCA. Very, very simple stuff. The certificates, that's gotten better. I wish I had time. I would love to show you this new N10 certificate wizard that we have in the Exchange Administration Center. If you haven't seen it yet, I strongly recommend that you download the preview and check it out, because it's very, very cool. And it really makes certificates much, much easier, even easier than we had in 2010 when we had a new certificate UI inside the console and some of the other things that we were doing with the certificate wizards. We've made it even better in 2013. And of course, like you heard me say before, you only need to be concerned with certificates on your client access servers for 2013. You don't put certificates on the back-end server. We'll use the built-in self-signed certificates for that. And then we've also added some expiration notification. If you've used EAC at all, you may have seen some of the pop-up reminders that we bubble up to administrators. And one of those reminders is when, for example, a certificate is about to expire. So when a cert's about to expire, when the administrator logs into EAC, they get a little pop-up alert that says, this certificate is about to expire. And they can go ahead and take care of it right at that time, or they can delay, and if they delay and wait, they'll get another pop-up next time they come in. And then we'll actually show you the first one 30 days before, and if you keep ignoring that, we keep telling you day after day after day. Obviously, once you get to that point where the cert's expired, then you've really got to take action at that point. So we will keep telling you when it comes time to do that, when you have to go ahead and upgrade those certs. So the best practices for certs, we'll have time for questions at the end. So the best practices for certs really is based on how you're handling your namespaces. We really want you to minimize the number of namespaces that you'd use. You don't need, for example, a separate namespace for Outlook web app versus the one you may be using for, say, for instance, an IMAP or a POP client, or maybe even an Outlook client. Minimize the number of host names, because each and every name that goes on a certificate costs money. And this already is going to be a slightly more expensive certificate because you're probably going to be using a subject alternative name certificate so that you can support multiple names, like your primary namespace, the auto-discover namespace, and so forth, the legacy namespace if you need it. So keep that in mind. We always want you to minimize the number. And there's never, ever, 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 ever any reason to put the Exchange server name on the certificate. Never, ever do that. We don't need it. We don't want it. There are some products that do want it. There are some link cases where they want the server name on the certificate. So if you're buying a certificate for use by multiple products, you may have additional requirements put onto your certificate by those other products. But for Exchange, never, ever, ever put the server names in there. We don't need them. We don't want them. And you'd really be doing yourself a disservice because it's going to cost you money. And if something happens and that server goes away, now you've got this cert out there that really can't be used by anything. So don't do that. Just stick with the namespaces we want. Then you'll validate using EXRCA. Again, that's basically just using our web tool to do stuff. And of course, you're going to be configuring load balancing, but it's not going to be as hard as how you were doing it in 2010. In 2010, you had to do layer 7 load balancing, which meant you had to create all these different, you know, iRules if you're using an F5 solution, for example. And that gets increasingly more and more complex, particularly as non-Exchange workloads start to use the same load balancer. Trying to reconcile all those different rules and all these different protocols and the number of different clients that could access them can be really hard. And it can be really expensive, particularly if you're driving towards any sort of scale. As I was saying earlier this week, that was one of the challenges we saw in the service. In order to scale the number of connections higher and higher and higher, we had to just keep adding more and more and more load balancers. And when you run a very large global service, you are constantly driven to reduce costs. So if you have a mechanism whereby you have to keep adding this expensive hardware, you want to do something about that. And we did. We re-architected Exchange so that we don't need layer 7 load balancers anymore. You could simply use a layer 4 load balancer and maybe even by RTM if we're done with it. Something as simple as round-robin DNS or Windows Network Load Balancing, something light, inexpensive, and easy to use. And those will be the options that you'll have for you. Now, after you've done all that changes, after you've updated everything, after you've got the namespaces, the certificates, every way you want, again, the last thing that you're going to use, of course, I hate to sound like a broken record, but it's to use EXRCA again to validate the environment both internally and externally. Okay, and that's super critical because that is going to be the first tool that if you did have some sort of a problem and you called someone at Microsoft for support, that's going to be the first tool they're going to want you to run anyway just to verify connectivity. So save yourself that call. Run the tool. The tool's very good about finding things that are misconfigured or aren't working and telling you what they are and how to fix them. So what will the coexistence flow look like? What would it look like if I have, say, for instance, 2010 and 2013 inside the same org in a coexistence? So up at the top, again, we've got our client up there. We're using a single namespace because we're 2010 and 2013 of mail.contoso.com. I've got a layer 4 load balancer in front of the Exchange 2013 CAS server. I've got a mailbox server separately over here. And of course, over there, we've got a separate 2010 CAS and 2010 mailbox server as well. So let's say this is an Outlook web app client. They make a request. The request goes into CAS. Remember, even in the coexistence scenario, the newer server always front ends everything. So all requests are going to come into CAS 2013, and CAS 2013 is going to authenticate that request. It's going to look at that mailbox. It's going to look in AD. It's going to maybe talk to Active Manager if it's in a DAG, figure out where that mailbox is, figure out what server hosts the active copy so that it can send the communication over there. So in this case, for a 2010 user, though, the 2013 CAS is going to recognize, well, you've got a legacy mailbox. So I'm going to go ahead and I'm going to send this over to CAS, and that 2010 CAS will then go ahead and talk to the mailbox on your behalf. Okay, so it's a very, very simple coexistence scenario. You don't need to give users a new URL. They just keep using the same URL, and they get right into their new mailbox or to their old mailbox, depending on where they are. Now, let's just say that that was all happening in one site. We also obviously have the ability to coexist across 80 site boundaries as well. So what we've done now is we've taken 2010, and we still have it in one of our other sites that we simply haven't upgraded yet. And the protocol flow is pretty similar. Again, OWA going into the 2013 CAS, which front ends everything, the 2013 CAS recognizing that this is a 2010 mailbox, and through discovery finding out that the mailbox is located on the server in the other site. And so it goes ahead and does the cross-site proxy request to proxy that over to the 2010 CAS, which gets the data from the 2010 mailbox server. Okay. Again, a very, very simple connectivity and communication flow. Now, let's say that instead of cross-site proxy, let's say you actually had the ability to do redirection. So this second site that we've been talking about, we're saying is now, yes, it's internet-facing. Okay, so that means there's a VIP in front of it, external, that we can get to. There's a load balancer up there in front of it. It has a different namespace in this case because it's a region where they want a different namespace. So in this case, the organization has carved up separate namespaces for Exchange 2010, the primary still being mail.contoso.com, and their one being europe.mail.contoso.com over the other site. So the request for OWA comes in again, front-ended by 2013. 2013 recognizes that their mailbox is on the 2010 mailbox server in the remote site. So we'll go ahead and say, nope, it's in the remote site, and that remote site is internet-facing, so instead of proxying the request, it's going to go ahead and redirect the user over to that CAS in the other site, and then that CAS in the other site will talk to the mailbox database that's locally in that site as well. Okay, so that's the 2010 coexistence scenario. Let's briefly look at what 2007 looks like. And again, it's very, very similar. It looks a lot like 2010, except we have that extra moving component of the legacy namespace in play. So over here, again, we're all in one site. We still have the old 2007 infrastructure. It's got the layer 7 load balancer in front of it. It's using the legacy.contoso.com namespace. We have our new infrastructure, the mail.contoso.com, same OWA client making the same request to the 2013 CAS server that is fronting this. The 2013 CAS server, again, locates the database, finds out that it's on the 2010 mailbox or the 2007 mailbox server, and it will get the redirection command. And it will send that over to the layer 7 load balancer that's fronting the 2007 CAS, and that will go ahead, accept the request, and then communicate with the store on behalf of that user. So it's a very, very similar process. Again, the only difference is you do have to set up this second separate namespace. Now, let's take a little bit further. Again, going to another site. This can be a non-internet facing site, for example, and you can tell that because I don't have a load balancer or any sort of presence on top of it. So again, the request comes in. We find that the mailbox is now over here in this other site. We go ahead and send the request back. We send the request over to a layer 7 load balancer that can deal with it because there is none in the site we want to talk to. The layer 7 load balancer talks to its local CAS that it can reach, one of the CAS in the CAS array, and that will reach across the site boundary and go CAS to CAS in the form of a cross-site proxy request. All right, now let's say that is an internet-facing site over here. You're going to start to see a pattern of how this goes. This is an internet-facing site, so again, the flow goes through. We see that it's there, but we don't need to send it over to the mailbox server or the 2007 CAS server that's in our local site. We don't need to do that because we've got a place over here that we can send it to. So we go ahead and we redirect it over to here, and now they're talking to the 2007 server that's in the other site, and that server will talk to the store on their behalf. And now you've got your cross-site redirect. So the proxying, the redirection, that's still largely all working the same exact way. Okay, so it's just like we had in 2010, and the upgrade path is very similar from 2007 to 2010. It's just gotten better going from 2010 to 2013. I'm not going to go over this. This is just a quick chart I threw in there so that you had something to compare to what the 2007 user experience would be and what the 2010 user experience would be. You can see it's not quite as clean with the 2007 side. 2010, everything's proxy, proxy, proxy. But 2007, it's going to depend on the protocol in terms of what the experience is going to be. Some are going to be proxy, some will be redirect, others will trigger auto-discover, and auto-discover will send the client to the right place based on that. All right. Last thing, of course, building out the DAG, moving the users. We have a new mechanism that we can use to move mailboxes. It's still an online move mailbox like we have in 2010, but this is using a new service, this new migration service that allows us to move mailboxes online in batches. And this is just a mechanism whereby you can have greater control over the actual migration process. Because when you're migrating, particularly from a messaging system that's been in use for quite some time, you're going to be moving a lot of data over. And you don't want the data coming over to overwhelm the new system, particularly if you're in a replicated environment. You don't want a massive amount of data coming in to overwhelm your replication pipeline and so forth. So we have this new migration service that allows you to make moves in batches and basically schedule a bunch of stuff to go as you would want it to go. We've got some new commandlets that are available that go with it, and you can also do this work from the Exchange Administration Center as well. So you can use command line or the GUI to move either the normal move mailbox or through the migration service. It's your choice, any way that you want to move it at your speed. All right, let's talk a little bit about public folder migrations. Let me just do a quick check on the time here. Ooh, we're getting tight. All right, so public folders, for those of you who weren't in the architecture session, they are now mailbox database centric. Okay, so there's no public folder database anymore. A public folder is now a type of mailbox. So the migration process is slightly different. Let me walk you through what that looks like. And I'm actually going to skip a couple of these so you can see these. It's this one. Okay, so the migration process is basically a hard cutover process. Okay, so what that means is you will be taking your existing public folders, moving them to the 2013 world, and then flipping a switch. And when you flip the switch, you won't be using public folders in the old system anymore. You'll be using the modern public folders in the new system. Now, let's say you wanted to go back and use the old public folder for whatever reason. You can do that. You can de-migrate, if you will. But there's no connectivity between the old and the new, which means that any of the changes that you make after the cutover takes place, if you revert back, you lose all those changes because they only exist in the new world. And if you go back to the old world, you can't take the new stuff with you. So keep that in mind. For those of you who have a lot of public folders, you're going to want to do a lot of planning. You're going to want to analyze your public folder hierarchy and your public folders to see whether or not you actually need to move everything over. And if you don't, maybe you're just able to leave some of that old stuff behind and only carry forward the most important stuff. So you can copy public folder data during the migration process, and users can continue using it because the data migration is all happening in the background. Once the data migration is done, though, that's when it's up to the administrator to flip the switch and do the actual cutover. And again, once you do that, the world will change from a back-end perspective in terms of what data you're using. The world will not change from the end-user perspective. The end-user will fire up their client, and they'll see the same public folder structure that they're used to seeing in Outlook. They'll see the ability to access content that they had access to before. They'll see the ability to create new folders and so forth. That experience will remain unchanged for those users. And then once you're done, you'll do a switch. You're going to have to inform the users because, again, it's a hard cutover where you're basically disconnecting the old stuff and hooking up the new stuff. And then once you're done, you're moving forward at that point. Again, if you want to go back, you do so without the changes you took moving forward. All right. The only other thing to say when it comes to managing coexistence, just as we've done with every other version, we want you to use the new management tools to manage the new objects and the legacy management tools to manage the legacy objects. So for instance, if you've got 2013 and 2007 in the same organization, you'll use 2013 to manage new objects, new users, new mailboxes, anything in the 2013 world. You'll use the management tools for 2007 to do the management of your 2007 objects. Okay? If you try to manage a newer object with the legacy one, we'll block that. And the legacy objects simply aren't available for manipulation through the newer tools. So you can't make that mistake accidentally. All right, so I think I've talked about the summary enough. Because I'm tight on time, I want to talk real quick about third-party mapping products, and then I'm going to talk real briefly about virtualization as well, as I promised. So obviously, with the change going from MAPI over TCP to MAPI over HTTPS, or RPC over HTTP, basically, that means if you're using any third-party MAPI products, they need to be re-engineered so that they work using only RPC over HTTP or the Outlook Anywhere path. Okay, because the old path, the RPC over TCP, isn't there anymore. There's no RPC endpoint that will answer anymore. So if you need the new MAPI, you're going to have to go and get it. There will be a package that we release that you can download and use it. But again, the applications will need to be changed by the developers so that they use Outlook Anywhere instead. Now, as you can see, as we're forecasting, we expect Exchange 2013 to be the last version that we will ship this MAPI package. Okay, moving forward, people should now be using Exchange Web Services. In fact, quite frankly, they should have been using them starting a few years ago, but of course we can't force everybody to do what we want. But the reality is, this is happening. Okay, so Exchange Web Services is the future. That's your development paradigm. All right, let me talk about virtualization. And this wasn't, again, this wasn't originally planned to include this, but so many people asked about it. And it is somewhat related to deployment, so I did want to talk about it. And I don't have a lot to say, because in large part, the support stance is largely identical to what we had in 2010. There are a couple differences, which I'll point out in a minute, but by and large, it's almost exactly the same as what we had in 2010. And of course, why are we talking about this? Because people virtualize Exchange. And as you could with 2007, 2010, as you could with 2003 even, you can virtualize Exchange 2013 as well. Okay, so what can you virtualize it on? I don't know why, I think my clicker died. So we support largely the same set of hypervisors that we had for Exchange 2010. So Windows Server 2008 R2, Windows Server 2012, Hyper-V, of course, itself, Hyper-V Server 2012, and so forth. And any third-party hypervisor that meets Exchange system requirements that is listed in the Server Virtualization Validation Program, SVVP. Okay, so if you're not familiar with that, go to www.windowsservercatalog/SVVP. That's where that list is maintained. We support third-party hypervisors in tandem with that vendor once they've made it to that list. The list is for hypervisors that have passed validation and for vendors that we've signed joint support agreements with. If it's not on the list, it's not supported. All exchange roles are supported for virtualization. I say all, I should just say both. There's only two now. Makes it sound like there's so much more. Both roles are supported for virtualization. You can virtualize CAS, you can virtualize mailbox, you can virtualize a combo CAS mailbox server. Storage has to be block level. It's all the same requirements in terms of storage that we had in Exchange 2010. That has not changed. What will be changing, though, obviously we're going to be introducing support for some of the new Windows Server 2012 storage features. I'm not going to be talking about that this week, but that will change. It's something I just wanted to give you the heads up on. For host-based clustering, if you want to use hypervisor-based high availability, again, we support all the roles, including a mailbox server that's a member of a DAG. You can co-locate that inside a highly available hypervisor. For the migration, in terms of hypervisor migration technologies, again, all the roles are supported there as well. And just as we recently introduced for Exchange 2010, in Exchange 2013, you can also use JetStress in the guest to validate the storage infrastructure in the guest as well. That was something that we worked very, very hard to do. We were able to get it in for 2010 and carry it forward for 2013. This really is just dead. All right, things that aren't supported. Almost everything that's not supported is not supported because it has destructive capabilities for Exchange. Things like playing with the amount of memory that you give to it, or playing with the amount of CPU that you give to it, or doing crazy things like taking an Exchange server back in time. Those things can have devastating consequences for your Exchange servers, and so as a result, we don't support these kinds of things. So, dynamic memory and any memory over commit type features, not supported for Exchange. And in fact, it can cause bad things to happen for your Exchange because Exchange does not support hot add memory. You can take memory away from Exchange, and obviously it goes away and Exchange can't use it, but dynamic memory doesn't just take memory away. Sometimes it gives memory. But because Exchange doesn't support hot add memory, which is basically how dynamic memory works, Exchange will never see or use that memory. So all dynamic memory can do is take memory away from Exchange. It can never give it back. You don't want to be in that situation. Hypervisor snapshots, another bad thing for a production environment. Fantastic for labs, beautiful for test and development environments, provided you're comfortable with reverting back the entire topology, including Active Directory. But if you're cool with that, you can do it. I do it in my lab all the time. It is awesome. I love snapshots. Can't use them in production, though, because snapshots imply taking a server back in time. And every Exchange server has state. And that state is somewhat time dependent and dependent on configuration data inside of AD. If you take an Exchange server back in time, it destroys it. It's unrecoverable at that point. So we don't support snapshots in production environments. They're for labs and demos only. And of course, along with snapshots go with things like differencing and delta disks. So we don't support those either. We want fixed disks for Exchange storage in a virtualized environment. Apps on the root, same thing. Lightweight apps only, management apps. Don't go to the root of your hypervisor and install another instance of Exchange. Don't put SQL on the root, SAP, Oracle, any other heavy server-based apps. Don't put them on the root. The root is for lightweight management apps, you know, inventory, updates, backup, antivirus, that type of stuff is okay. The super heavy apps, though, not cool. Don't do it. Not supported. And then processor oversubscription. We have a support boundary where we require you to oversubscribe processors no greater than a 2-to-1 ratio, two virtual processors for every one core that you have in the box. And that includes across all the workloads. That's not just the Exchange guest VMs. That's all the workloads on the system. And you may find, even if you're approaching that ratio, that you might not have enough processor capability, and you might even have to actually back off from that. We generally actually prefer a 1-to-1 ratio between virtual processors and physical cores. That is the best practice. Now, there's other stuff that's in here. I had some charts where I was going to show you some best practices. Like, here's one of the reasons dynamic memory is so bad. Okay, so what you're looking at here Pay in particular attention to the yellow line there, because the yellow line is the RPC average latency, and that is one of the key metrics that we look at when we're determining how snappy the performance of a mailbox is. And so you can see, just looking at this graph, that something is certainly going on here, particularly in this area from about here to here. We're humming along, RPC latency is low, or actually we're coming from this way, RPC latency is low, and then all of a sudden it starts to shoot up. Why does it shoot up? Well, as we look a little bit deeper into this, we get rid of some of the noise and we add another counter in there. What happens is, it turns out, because dynamic memory was in play, the available bytes drop down to almost nothing. Something else needed the memory, and the dynamic memory was taken away from Exchange and given to whatever that other need was. And in doing that, once all that memory went away from Exchange, it just sent RPC average latency through the roof. It killed the user experience. Okay, so dynamic memory, even if we could allow it to be given back to Exchange, again, which we can't, having it taken away from Exchange also does pretty bad things, particularly for the user experience. All right, so there's other stuff in here as well, and these will be in the decks that you get. Again, we've talked about the time traveling and the snapshots and so forth, and the overcommit. Definitely don't overcommit. We don't like that from an Exchange perspective. We like Exchange to be designed in a virtual environment as if it were a physical environment. So don't do the overcommitting, because it's generally not a good idea. Okay, so with that, I do realize that I'm out of time. I know that some of you have questions, and I'm happy to take those off to the side. I don't know, do we have somebody coming up right away? It's lunchtime, so maybe I could convince you guys to stay around for another 5 minutes to win a car.